this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 26th, 2009, and this is show number 216. We have a huge show today. We're going to talk about how Apple TV sucks and Pat Dengler rocks. I'm going to show you how happy I am with the headlines in the Wall Street Journal. We have a review of Bump for the iPhone that will make you will take you down memory lane. Donald Burr's going to explain why I'm a bad, bad influence on him. And we have an interview with Don McAllister of Screencast Online, where he tells tales of technology in faraway lands. And in Chit Chat Across the Pond, Bart answers Paul from Peru's not-so-dumb question about why there are limits on how many wireless clients a router can handle. I sure hope the LA traffic is really bad on Monday so Robert Lachman has time to listen to this marathon show on his commute to work. We'd better dig in or we'll be up all night long. Well, like I said, the title of this next story is Apple TV Sucks and Pat Dengler Rocks. But let me start at the beginning. Steve loves buying me tech toys, and it gives him great pleasure to see me play with them. For my birthday, I asked for an Apple TV, so to my delight, he bought me one. The bad news is that the Apple TV is a very un-Apple-like product, in my opinion. The great joy of Apple products is that they just work. If you're struggling, you're doing it wrong. When we first set up the Apple TV, we were dumbfounded on how to get started. We stumbled around in the menus trying to figure out how to get it to talk to our iTunes and iPhoto and Aperture libraries, but there was nothing on screen to tell us how to do that. I did a bunch of Googling, not Binging, and I figured out that you have to actually start in iTunes on your Macs to get this whole thing to work. Well, you know, I'm not big on manuals, but this was so obscure, I think it really does need a manual to tell you that. I went to Steve's Mac upstairs where our music lives. Well, you know, it's not on my Mac, right? And in iTunes on the left side, we found the Apple TV under Devices. Turns out you're supposed to click on that and set your sync options there. I think I figured out it's kind of like you should think about the Apple TV as a gigantic iPod. In our case, a 160 gigabyte iPod. So if you wanted to put something on your iPod, you'd hook it to a Mac and select it in the Devices on iTunes and then tell it what to sync. Easy peasy, right? Except who thinks of something hooked to your TV as a giant iPod? Oh well, we're finally getting somewhere. So I figured at this point, I had the thing covered, so I synced Steve's music to the Apple TV from his iMac. Now to sync my photos from my MacBook Pro. I go into iTunes, select the Apple TV under Devices, and iTunes crashes. Great. I brought it back up again. I selected the Apple TV again, and it crashed again. All night long, I kept trying to figure it out. I deleted plists. I deleted so many plists, I lost connection to my libraries in iTunes. So I had to kind of put those back because it didn't have any applications, for example. But I got back in, and it was still crashing every time I selected the Apple TV in the Devices. Well, I went to sleep in a snit, but the next morning, I woke up, and I tried again, and it didn't crash. Go figure. All right, fine. Now I go into iTunes, and guess what? It won't let me sync my photos. I don't understand. Did I do something wrong? I did some more reading online. Don't you think there should be a manual? Anyway, I discovered that you can only sync one computer with the Apple TV. The other computers must stream their data. Well, isn't that lovely? I have my photos and Steve's music on the Apple TV. I can't have them both. Cripes, I give up. So, we've established that the Apple TV sucks so far, but now it's time for me to explain why Pat Dengler rocks. I tweeted about how I couldn't figure this silly thing out, and she volunteered to come over to my house to give me Apple TV lessons. How cool is that? It's like I've got my own Honda Bob only for technology. So, she comes over, and it wasn't even simple for her, I do have to say. We had to run a whole bunch of experiments before we were both clear on exactly what it was doing. It was kind of an it-takes-a-village thing. Again, an Apple product is not supposed to be this hard. What we finally settled on was that my Mac would be synced to the Apple TV, so my photos would live there, and Steve's would stream. It seemed like since I have like a kajillion photos, it would be easier to have the music stream than a kajillion photos. Well, we got that all set up and working fine, so I waxed her car. It seemed like the logical thing to do, and since it's actually a Mini Cooper convertible, that meant the entire job of claying and waxing only took like a half hour. Okay, so technically I only did the hood and the trunk, but it looked fantastic. Now, fast forward a week, and I'm finally getting excited about the Apple TV, so I thought I'd give renting movies on it a try. I went into movies. I picked out the movie Push, which I chose because I'd seen Pat tweet that she was watching it. I had no idea what it was about, but it sounded like fun. So it was a delightful interface, easy peasy. I clicked rent, and then I realized I'd clicked the standard def version. Ah, couldn't believe I did that. You see, Steve is a darling man, but if something is not in high def, he hates it. Doesn't matter what it is, not high def, he hates it. Well, there's $4 down the toilet because I went back in and I rented the high def version for $5. This movie better be good, I'm thinking. Well, I decided to rationalize it with him by saying I rented both so we could do a comparison of the quality. Pretty smart, huh? I figured he'd fall for that. So at that point, I couldn't check out the movies myself because the stupid DRM says you have 30 days to watch it. But if you start watching it, you only have 24 hours before it turns into a pumpkin like Cinderella's carriage. I really think that should be like 2 days. I mean, you should at least have the weekend to watch it, I would think. Well, fast forward again now to Friday night when our buddy Ron comes over and we settle down to watch a nice movie. We excitedly turn on the Apple TV, go into rented movies, and we decide to check out the standard def version first, again to do our comparison. So we hit play, and the screen turns white. Yep, just white. It's widescreen white, though, with black bars at the top and the bottom, so it feels like something's happening. We hit fast forward, and you can faintly see scene selections changing at the name at the bottom, and there was kind of a little progress bar going on. What the heck? So we backed out of the standard def version. We went back to the high def version, or went to the high def version to start that one, and again we get the white screen. Well, Steve's really thrilled with the Apple TV at this point, so I hit the panic button on my cell phone, which goes directly to the red phone over at Pat Dengler's house. Even though she's never rented from iTunes before, her first guess turned out to be right of what was wrong. Turns out the default setting on the Apple TV, which I don't think we had messed with, was that the TV resolution was set in the Apple TV to be 1080p. Now, had we messed with it, we would have changed it to 1080p because that's the native resolution of our television. Turns out you have to switch it to 720p. Great. I have to know to do that? How about a manual? How about something telling me that? Doesn't even matter because the first time I tried to do this, the Apple TV locks up and I actually have to pull the power to make it work. Ah, making me crazy. So finally, after we rebooted the whole thing, we got it into 720p and the movie came up. By the way, it's not a great movie. I don't know if I'd bother. And I paid $11 for it, $9 for it. So it was okay. It was kind of like Heroes Redux. It was a lot like Heroes. Anyway, if I can't stop slamming the Apple TV for just a minute, the comparison of the two resolutions of the movie was very interesting. We played the standard def one first, and it looked really, really good. We were all just kind of like, wow, that looks pretty good. We did a few freeze frames, and they looked surprisingly good too. So then we switched to the high def version, and we saw a few things that looked, a teeny bit better. And then I thought, wait a minute, did I actually switch it? Nope. We had watched the standard def one twice, but we were able to see differences as it turned out. So we finally switched to the real high def one. And to be honest, we really did not see much of a quality improvement because the standard def looked so stinking good. I personally don't think if we ever did this again, and I'm not sure we will, I'm not sure I'd recommend paying the extra dollar for high def, even if you have a very large flat screen TV. So the bottom line here is that the Apple TV sucks and Pat Dengler rocks. If you live in the LA area and you need a Mac doctor, check her out at yourmacdoctor.com. If you forget that, you can always find her link in the sidebar over at podfeet.com under blog roll. Well, I don't know if you've been following the technology financial news, but it has been a lovely week. I read the Wall Street Journal, and the headlines have been leaving me giggling with glee all week long. Wednesday, Apple announced its quarterly earnings, and the headline was Apple net up 15% on iPhone surge. Yes, in the worst economy we've had in ages, they had a 15% increase in profit. Now, I gotta say, Macintosh sales actually went up 4% in the quarter, too, in spite of all the talk about them being too expensive. But they beat the slumping PC market, as they say. Now, I should point out that revenue for the Macs actually slid 8% because they cut the prices on some of the MacBook models. So it wasn't quite as good as it could have been. But still, up 15%. Apple net up 15% on iPhone surge. Yay! Well, that made me really happy. But then the two headlines on Friday just put me over the top. I walked around with my Wall Street Journal all day long because it was so beautiful. Friday's front page of the Wall Street Journal was splashed with the words, stocks recapture 9,000 on profit surprise. They had a big graph covered with green showing that the market has recovered back to the January numbers. There were even big green arrows showing Ford, Amazon, and 3M beating earnings estimates. This was just fantastic news. But that's not what put me over the edge, grinning from ear to ear. What really made me happy was the next headline on Friday. It said, hit by PC blight, Microsoft profits skids 29%. Okay, I know I shouldn't gloat, and it's really mean, but, you know, it was so beautiful, and it had a picture of Steve Ballmer with his hand on his head with five big red arrows beneath the photo showing quarterly earning drops from a year ago in servers, online, office, entertainment, and the biggest drop, 29% in Windows. Now, I suppose you could explain the last one with everyone waiting by Windows 7, but still, it was a lovely, lovely headline. Yes, I'm petty and ungracious. Perhaps living through the Apple's dead years hardened me and made me unsympathetic, but I make no apologies. Have I mentioned lately how much I like screen steps? Yeah, I know I mention it every week, don't I? Well, I do, though. I love it. I love making tutorials for people, helping them understand how to do something on the Mac or on Windows. All right, I got to be honest. When I make tutorials on Windows, it's usually to document it for myself because I can't figure out how to use anything on Windows, and I document it in screen steps so I can figure it out a second time. I love how screen steps lets you do timed screenshots so it's trivial to capture pull-down menus, and the annotations are so much fun. I love putting in big yellow ball numbers to show the sequence of steps in a clean interface, being able to change colors, line thickness, radius, unrounded, rectangle, highlights. It's all so much fun. Especially compared to doing it in Word, that's for sure. You know, you can try Screen Steps for 30 days for free, and if you don't find it as fun as I do, you don't have to keep it. But you know what? So far, even those who resisted for a long time and were convinced they didn't need it, they all write in the end, yeah, I gave in. And I used the NoSilla coupon, that's Allison's name spelled backwards in all capital letters, to get 25% off. And you know what? They're all happy as clams. Come on, what's $40? Hey, $30 after the discount for all this happiness you can spread. Check it out at screensteps.com. If you ever owned a Palm device back in the day, a Palm Pilot, a Palm OS Trio, or a Sony Clié, you probably miss one of the coolest features of those devices. No, not the fact that you got to learn a whole new alphabet called graffiti playing a game called Giraffe, whose name defies explanation. No, you probably don't miss that you had to use a stylus instead of your finger, which seems to always be available. You probably don't even miss syncing to the Palm desktop, because you have all of that in your iPhone now. What you might actually miss is the ability to beam your business card to someone instead of having to carry all those pesky paper ones, you know? Remember how cool it was when you'd meet someone as geeky as you and they actually knew about it? You'd just go, oh, let me beam it to you. It was awesome. It was a little infrared thing. It worked great, and it was really fun to do. When I was at the Enterprise 2.0 conference back in Boston, I met a delightful gentleman named David Kuhn at one of the events, and I reached for my card to give it to him, and he said, why don't you just bump it to me? Say what? He showed me that all of the functionality of the old beaming between Palm OS devices is alive and well in a free application called Bump from bumptechnologies.com. Open Bump on two iPhones or iPod Touches and gently bump your hands together. Well, I guess they don't want you cracking the devices into each other. And using 3G, Edge, or Wi-Fi, obviously the iPod Touches would have to be on Wi-Fi, the devices will both say Establishing Secure Link, and then they'll display the message Connection Established With and show the other person's contact information, usually just their photo and their name. At that point, you can cancel out or confirm the transfer. If you confirm, you get a final screen telling you that you've exchanged your information with the other person. If you'd like to tailor what information gets transferred using Bump, when you open it up, there's a screen that lets you decide to share your phone number, email, photo, address, or your entire contact card. I think that's really cool because there's a lot of people with whom I would share my email address, but I'm not that hip on giving out my home address or even my cell phone number. I put some screenshots into the show notes so you can see what the screens look like. I am delighted to have this capability back with Bump from Bump Technologies. And again, you can find it at bumptechnologies.com, and it's free.
Hey, it's Donald Burr of Otakno Podcast. New episodes, by the way. Yay! And I've got a message for you, Allison. You are a bad influence. You see, last week I was listening with great interest to your review of the Verizon MiFi card. For some reason, I just could not get that out of my head. And today, I was in my local Sprint store. See, I am a Sprint customer. I just like their service better, and, well, we have a family account and all that. Anyways, I was in my local Sprint store, and I think I was in there to buy a cell phone case or something. Anyways, I was commiserating with a guy behind the counter about the sad state of my Evdo card. You see, a little while back, it took a rather nasty fall, and it's quite literally held together with super glue and duct tape, and it's not pretty, and I'm convinced that it's not quite getting as good a reception as it used to because it maybe got damaged or something when it fell. Anyways, I was commiserating with the guy behind the counter when he said, "You know, we have these newfangled MiFi Wi-Fi hotspot thingies," and my eyes just lit up. Well, long story short, I bought a MiFi card. Actually, they're out of stock, and they're having one shipped to me from the warehouse, so I don't actually get it until Monday. Wah. But, Allison, shame on you. You're a bad influence on me. Well, okay, maybe the conversation didn't exactly go like that. To be honest, maybe my mind was kind of filling in, interpolating what the guy was saying and kind of filling in the blanks. The way it probably went was I happened to see a MiFi card on the shelf, and I say, "Hey, you guys have those now? How much would it cost for me to get one and replace this crappy Evdo card?" Oh, well, I may be doomed, but at least I've got to play with the cool toys. And this way I can legitimately say, I've got the internet in my pocket. New kind of geek pickup line? "Hey, baby, I got the internet in my pocket." Yeah, maybe not. Anyways, shame on you, Allison. Love the show.
I don't know, Donald. I'm the kind of woman that a man who said I have the internet in my pocket, I would think that's hot and sexy. So, you know, use that line if you need it. I'm telling you. I'm the woman who has the internet in her purse, and it seems to be working great for me. But I'm so sorry, so dreadful that I was being, you know, it's such a bad influence on you. Just go hang out with Michael King, and it'll cost you even more. So what the heck? Well, Jenna Duffy wins for being the first person to buy something from the new NoSilicast Cafe Press site. She bought a coffee cup and asked her for a Twitter-length review. I wanted to be sure this stuff is any good, you know, without buying anything from them myself. So here's what she said, and I'm quoting exactly to give you a good review. "It looks great. Your pictures are a little dark, though, but the whole logo is clear and nice." Well, I guess that's pretty good. There are some darker parts to the logo, but if she says it looks clear and nice, that's good enough for me. I hope you can go over and pick yourself up something pretty, or something for your dog, or your baby, or, you know, a clock, something fun. Check it out at cafepress.com/nosilicast. Well, Don McAllister of Screencasts Online was one of the speakers on the MacMania 09 cruise to China, Japan, and Korea, and I asked him if he'd chat with me about the state of technology in China today. So we got together on Skype for a bit of a chat across the pond, as it were. Anyway, here's that interview. Well, I've got a very special little interview planned for here. I've got the internationally famous Don McAllister of Screencasts Online on the line here, so we can have a little chat about his extraordinary adventures in China.
Hi, Allison. Hi. How are you?
Well, I'm glad you have finally mended from your cruise-related illnesses and you're back on your feet to do this. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, I'm about 90% there now, so I'm still a little bit bunged up, as we say, but I'll try and persevere, but your editing skills might be brought into play on this particular segment.
Yeah, I don't usually believe in editing, but what the heck. So, you know, a lot of people who talk to someone who just went to China might ask questions about, you know, how was the Great Wall, or tell me about the food, or what were the people like, what was the culture like? I don't care about any of that. I want to talk about the state of technology in China, of your observations of what the people there were using, or and your ability to continue to communicate with the world when you were in China. So what are your observations of the tools and things that other people are using there?
Right. Well, I suppose the main thing that struck me really is just that, you know, Asia seems so far away and so exotic, but, you know, it is a well-developed country and they have a good infrastructure of networks there. They have, you know, great. I mean, the cell phone network was fantastic. On the iPhone, the 3G reception in all the major cities that we went to was spot on, you know, probably better than we have here in the UK.
And certainly better than the US, apparently.
yeah. So that was a bit of an eye-opener as well. I mean, the problem that we did have, or the problem that I had initially, was obviously we were staying at really fairly decent hotels, so most of them had Wi-Fi.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, we could get Wi-Fi to the room. I could actually get onto all my services. I do my email perfectly well. Everything was fine. There were just a couple of services that were blocked, unfortunately, because of some of the trouble that was going on over in China at the time. So the first day, I think, we could get onto Twitter from the laptops. But then from the second day onwards, they'd actually blocked Twitter, and it was actually blocked by the Chinese government, as far as we were aware. Hmm. They blocked access to Twitter, and then they blocked access to Facebook. But that really didn't bother me. I'm not a big Facebook user. But they were a lot of the expats over there were quite upset that they weren't able to get onto these services. The interesting thing, though, was that I could actually still go onto those services using the iPhone.
Oh.
So although they blocked it on the, you know, the local area network and the WAN, the telecommunications network was fine.
So if you were on Wi-Fi, it would have stopped, though, right?
Wi-Fi, you just couldn't get through, yeah.
Okay,
you had to be on later.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. So
yeah, you think they're both really rather than just the one or the other.
Now, I also heard, Apple is going to be coming out with an iPhone for China that doesn't have Wi-Fi at all because they don't want people using Wi-Fi on their cell phones. And yet you were able to use your cell phone over Wi-Fi.
Yeah, fine. No problem. When there was Wi-Fi access, that was great. The interesting thing, though, was that we did go to, there's a place called the Silk Market, which is a multi-floored sort of shopping mall, but small stores. And in one of the floors, they have electronic equipment. And we took our life into our hands and decided to have a look around there. They're quite aggressive in trying to pull you into the stalls to have a look at the various.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you have to be a little bit standoffish, really, and not get too involved. But there was tons of iPhone ripoffs in there, and even mini iPhones, you know, little small MP3 iPhone. I very nearly bought one just to see what it was all about and bring it back and have a play with it.
Did you take any pictures of those?
To be honest, I didn't, because it was, it was a little bit, I wasn't too happy about pulling out my actual iPhone and starting taking snaps, so I didn't take a picture.
Just felt nervous.
I'm not sure if Andy was going to get one. I'm not sure if he actually got one or not, but Andy Narka might have got one.
Huh.
But the really strange thing as well is we traveled to a city in Xi'an, it was called. It's one of the oldest cities in China. And again, really nice hotel. We got in there. I just put the TV on just while we were unpacking, and the first channel that I put on was, I don't know, it was just a Chinese language channel. And they were actually, there was an advert on for the Apple phone.
Oh.
Not the iPhone, the Apple phone, it was called.
Oh, interesting.
And it was just a rip-off completely of the iPhone. Had an Apple logo on the back, but I think it didn't have the bite taken out of it. It was all in gold, and it was like a full-on advert about this new Apple phone. That was, you were saying it was $800 in the US, and you know, $600 in the UK, and you know, in China it was 50 quid or something. It was really cheap, but it was such a blatant ripoff of the iPhone. I couldn't believe it, and this was on sort of like national TV, sort of getting advertised.
So it's completely supported this idea of there being no such thing as intellectual property then.
Seems that way, to be honest. Yeah, it seems that way.
I mean, that's not turning a blind eye. That's almost endorsing to allow it to be out like that.
Yeah, I mean, the market thing, I could have thought, you know, that could have been a black market sort of thing. But to actually have it sort of advertised on the TV as a legitimate advertisement, I thought was a bit strange.
Wow. Hey, what were the Wi-Fi speeds like in the hotels?
It was okay. It was okay. To be honest, what I ended up doing in the main hotel in Beijing where we stayed, because I wanted to use the iPhone, because I wanted to use Skype on the iPhone, I ended up actually using the laptop plugged directly into the network, and then switching on an ad hoc network and using my iPhone using the Wi-Fi. So I didn't really use the Wi-Fi that much in the hotel room itself.
Oh, that's interesting. So you did hardwired with an ad hoc network, creating a Wi-Fi network to use your iPhone.
Yeah, and that worked really well. So it was only like 2 or 3 days after being there that we suddenly realized, why on earth have I been using my iPhone to dial the UK when I have got my Skype client on the iPhone?
And did that work well?
It worked fantastically. Yeah, it worked really, really well.
Wow, that's very cool. Now, do you Skype out? Like, are you calling a landline or a cell phone, or are you calling to a computer at home?
Yeah, Skype out. That's just using standard Skype out to a landline. Okay. Well, we did go to Guilin, which is down in the southern part of China, and we stayed at a really nice hotel there called the Homer Hotel, which was the Hotel of Modern Art. And although, again, they did have Wi-Fi in the hotel rooms, that really wasn't up to much. That was probably the worst sort of network connectivity that we had. And as soon as a dozen Mac geeks all turned up the hotel and everyone went to the hotel, it just went, "Egh." So I pretty much was without network access for a couple of days, other than the iPhone, when we were down in that part of the world.
Oh, wow. Now, before we started recording, you were talking about how you set up your data plan with your provider. Your provider is O2?
O2 over here in the UK, that's right, yeah. Yeah, well, I know Leo got a 100 megabit, or rather 100 megabyte data package for while he was away. Did a quick bit of research, and it turns out that I could get a 50 megabyte package for about £50.
Okay.
Which wasn't too bad. You know, I sort of experimented. It ruled out sending video from the iPhone, which is one of the things I really wanted to try.
Yeah.
To send video from the iPhone itself. But with that amount of data available to me, it wasn't really feasible. The movies on the iPhone, unless you get them off and compress them or change them, they're quite large.
Oh, they are. They're huge.
So, so it was really audio and images, you know, to send photos and the audio booths that I was sending across as well. So what I did is I set up a 50 megabyte package, and I'd probably use, it was mainly the first week I used most of the bandwidth, and that was about 50 to 60 megabytes. So I knew, well, according to the usage meter on my iPhone, I actually did go over my 50 megabytes.
Now,
Leo's
much.
Had a bad experience in that it looks as though his usage meter completely mismatches what his carrier thinks he used.
So I heard him talking about that. Yeah, that's he better not have to pay that extra bill.
No, because I think it looked as though he used about 60 megabytes, and they're saying he's used about 200 megabytes or something, which is a big deal. When,
what is that, $12,000?
It could be a lot. Well, the thing is with mine, I only discovered last night, again, I saw a tweet from Andy come out that he checked his bill, and I think he'd had a bill for about $140, which is what he was expecting, really, for the stuff that he'd sent out. I sort of not checked mine since I came back, so I thought I'd best jump on and check. And unfortunately, my bill, even though I'd paid £50 for the 50 megabytes, it's coming at $400, which is not really what I was expecting. But again, the power of Twitter, looks as though they've prorated the 50 megabytes over 2 billing cycles.
I hate that proration thing.
The billing cycle is only like 4 days into the trip, and that's when I use most of the data. So I'll sort that out with them tomorrow when the customer services are open.
So they gave you 4/30 of 50 megabytes, but that's when you use the 50 megabytes?
That's right. Yeah, well, it was probably 6 or 7 days. So those 6 or 7 days when it started, I was actually, that was the first week of the trip, which was my heaviest usage. So they've only gave me those, you know, the 7/50 of what I was allowed for that.
I hate the cell phone companies. You know, and people blame AT&T, and they think AT&T is this evil source here, but they all suck. They're all just
well, the thing is,
greedy leeches.
Explained it to me, I'd have been upset, but I said, look, okay, well, I don't want this to happen. You know, I'll take 2 months worth then, because, you know, I'm going to use the data. I'll pay for it because, you know, I want to use it, but not to tell me and then to try and, you know, sneak in a bill of $400. You know, it's crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Yeah, they tried to tell me they were prorating our text message plan, and that ended up being $200 in text message fees because I bought the iPhones mid-month. You know, mid-billing cycle. And I said, so you mean because I chose to send you a check for $400 for these 2 iPhones, that's why you're going to charge me extra? Yeah, you're just having trouble with that. They took it off, but, you know, it's like, well, you shouldn't have to spend, you know, an hour and a half of your day yakking to them.
I have to say, though, that the iPhone worked flawlessly, switching on the data. There was one instance when I couldn't get a signal, and that was because I had it switched to automatic carrier, and it didn't pick up the automatic carrier. But once I switched it off automatic and then let it find the carriers and then selected one, it worked fine. But how easy it was just to switch it on and to get instant data access, you know. And don't forget, well, it wasn't just China. We actually went to South Korea and Japan as well.
Oh, that's right.
And, you know, in all those countries, it just worked. There was no reconfiguration. Didn't have to change the WAP gateway or anything. I just switched on, connection, and bang, there it was, 3G signal. It was fantastic.
Oh, that's really good. Now, when you're on the ship, what kind of connectivity do you have there?
Very little.
Yeah.
None at all. So the ship really was probably for about 20 minutes in and out of port, you could get the 3G signal of the local harbor. But once you're actually out on the ocean waves, that was it. It was
nothing
completely
at all.
Dead.
Huh?
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah. Now, that was different on the last cruise I went on because we had some special arrangements. That was around the Mediterranean and they had satellite connectivity and it was they did some special arrangements for us to get Wi-Fi on the boat. But again, you know, once you get more than 10 or 20 Mac geeks all trying to access the internet, it's going to bring it down.
And but,
unfortunately,
they have
this one, didn't have the choice, really.
Wasn't that special, too, for you because you were... Or no, were you a speaker on the Mediterranean one?
Yeah, on the Mediterranean. Yeah, no, it was available to anybody, really. You had to pay extra as part of the package. But actually, I tell a lie, there was connectivity on the boat. They had an internet cafe.
Oh,
but
okay.
It was... How much was it? $1 a megabyte or $1 a minute or something like that? It was just horrendous. It was really expensive. And someone needed to do something. I said, well, you know, you can use the internet cafe. And apparently they tried to get onto Gmail and it took like 4 minutes to get a Gmail page loaded, which cost them $4. So, you know, it's not even worth going there.
That seems there's a market there for, internet connectivity on ships that needs to be cracked.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think I want to go on a cruise. I don't think I'd like to be away from the internet that long.
Well, it's a thing, isn't it? I mean, people now choose the cars because of the technology. They choose their houses and the locations where they live because of the connectivity that they can get there and things like that. So, yeah, it's probably one of the few holiday destinations that you're completely out of touch, at least for a couple of days at a time.
I did forgive the we went on a barefoot cruise, which is a 250-foot schooner down in the Caribbean. A 1900, year 1900 schooner. And I forgave them for not having high-speed internet.
Right.
We were sailing, for crying out loud.
Right.
But if I'm on a big, fancy cruise ship where I can buy, Tiffany's jewelry in a store inside the ship and gamble and all those kinds of things, you ought to be able to give me internet access. That shouldn't be that big of a stretch.
Yeah. Well, by the time I come to retire and go off on my world cruise and yet still do my screencasts, They've got to get this sorted out so I can actually, sail around the world and still do my screencasts from my cabin and post them in various parts throughout the world. So I'm sure they'll have it sorted by then, though.
That's good. Yeah, definitely. Well, one of the things you mentioned, and I haven't actually talked about on the show before, is there's a new service called Audioboo, where it's an application you load on the iPhone, and then you make a recording with Audioboo, and you click a link, and basically it sends it out. I think it connects in with Twitter, too. Is that right?
Yeah, it's something that actually it was a guy called Chris, I think, who's one of Leo's guests on one of his shows, recommended it to Leo, and it was just before the last MacBreak Weekly I was on, so I sort of listened in on the conversation, and Leo recommended it as well. So this Audioboo service. So basically, it's a free service. I actually think it's UK-based. I might be wrong on that. But it's an audio service that you can get a client on your iPhone, and you can record, I think, up to 5 minutes worth of audio. And then once you've recorded the audio, you can then capture a picture, and you can also capture your location information as well, and then send that into Audioboo. You transmit it from the iPhone, and it appears on Audioboo servers. But it also sends a link across to Flickr so that people can click on a link.
Twitter,
and take
you mean?
It across. Sorry, did I say Flickr? Yeah. Twitter. Yes.
I get those two mixed up all along.
Well, I was so many different services going on because I used it as a bit of an experiment because I set up an iWeb service, which is still available, actually, if anyone wants to try it out. If they go to screencastonline.com/MacMania09, there's an iWeb website which has got the standard things you might expect, such as mobile me galleries, etc., because I wanted to test publishing to mobile me galleries. But I also set up a special page. There's a new RSS widget within iWeb09 that allows you to embed an RSS feed. So I actually took the Audioboo RSS feed and embedded that on that page so people could go there and click on the Audioboos and get access to those pages.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Ghostbusters. I think you're going to cross the beams here pretty soon, Don. You know, I gotta bust your chops for one thing. Throughout your trip, I kept trying to find your iWeb page, and I couldn't find links to it. I looked on your blog, on My Own Reality, I think it's called, right? And I looked on the Screencast Online page. I even drilled down into the site map trying to find it, and I couldn't find it.
Oh, right. Yeah, it was just Screencast. I put a divert on. My bad.
Now that you've pointed it to me, I apparently found it once before because it filled it in automatically when I started looking for it. But it, I got to go back and look at this. But what I was going to say was the audio booths were fantastic. It was just like you'd called me on the phone and said, "Hey, check it out. I'm right here and getting some food and listen to the sounds here." And Steve was really, really liking it. And he'd say, "Oh, Don's got another boo," and we'd run to go listen.
Yeah, the hardest part was just doing the first one, just getting the first one under your belt. So once I'd done the first one, I felt a lot happier about doing it. Of course, we had, with Leo being on there doing audio booze as well, we'd sort of walk past each other, both speaking into the iPhone, obviously both doing audio booze at the same time. And to listen to Leo's, mine was sort of, he's a pro, and I was just sort of playing with it. But that was quite interesting. And he brought me on a couple of his as well, as he sort of walked past. interesting as well, while he was actually recording some audio booze, I was actually taking video as well. So it was pretty much a team. So he'd be speaking and I'd actually be filming it. And there's the Great Wall of China video that I put up. I've got another great example of the use of the technology there. I said we couldn't send video because it was just too data hungry. So what I did is when it got back to the hotel room, I'd taken, probably 2 minutes, 3 minutes worth of video on the iPhone. I'd taken some still photos from the iPhone, and I'd taken some still photos from my PowerShot G10 as well. And I really wanted to show, the videos to people. And when I took the video, actually, Leo was actually describing the view from the Great Wall of China. So as you could hear him on my video describing the audio boo, I actually panned so you could actually see what he was looking at. And I thought, well, that'd be really cool to put that out as a video. So I took it back to the hotel room, dumped it into iMovie, and just created like literally a 3 minute video. Because the actual video itself was quite short, I thought, well, I'll throw some images in as well. All went in automatically, just pull them across. It did all the transitions automatically, didn't have to do anything. I just searched for Chinese MP3 in Google, found some Chinese music, brought that across, dropped that in, switched on ducking so that the music was sorted, and then just published it. And it literally took me about 10 minutes to create this like 2 or 3 minute video. And it was, I thought it was really effective.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, it's funny, you keep saying, Leo's the professional, but I just love your view of things and the way you describe things. And I don't know, the little phrases you use, I really, really enjoyed them. I thought it was a lot of fun. And so if people want to go back and watch that or look at the videos, so that was screencastonline.com/MacMania09.
Yeah. You might have to put the com in, I'm not sure. But yeah, just screencastonline.com/MacMania09.
Right.
And they'll see that. Actually, if they remember as well, the show I did from my sick bed this week was to go over how I actually built it. It's sort of like a two-part show. It's all about the updates to iWeb. And then the second part was how I actually put that website together and how I integrated the both the audio boo service, but also Tumblr. I used Tumblr while I was away to post pictures and post sort of text blog entries using the very same principle of embedding the RSS feed into the iWeb blog. And that, again, that worked tremendously well.
So you used Twitter, Tumblr, iWeb, Audio Boo.
Yeah.
Sorry,
mobile galleries and YouTube as well.
Well, I'm glad you, it sounds like you got a little bit of everything in there.
Actually, now you mentioned it, it sounds like $400 is a bargain, really, isn't it? Perhaps I shouldn't complain with OT.
If they had told you it was $400 up front, then it wouldn't be bad. But it is bad if they told you it was $50. All right, Don. Well, I will let you get back to things. This is really fun. I appreciate you taking the time to tell us about what it's like in China.
Yeah, it's. I'd love to go back there. It's a tremendously large country, obviously, and so much to see. But we had a fantastic time and got crammed in an awful lot. And because we did two parts. We did a pre-cruise tour, which was around inland China, and then on the cruise itself, we did. We left from China and went to South Korea and Japan, so we saw those other countries as well. So. Yeah, quite an experience.
Yeah, like China's not big enough. You fit in two other countries on the trip, right?
I have to tell you about the cultural stuff another time.
There you go. All right. Thanks for checking in with us, Don.
Anytime, Allison.
Well, I had a lot of fun talking to Don. He's such a delightful guy. He's just as genuine and wonderful as he sounds. He's just a fantastic guy. I'm really excited because he said he's going to come to Blog World Expo, and I'll be speaking at Blog World Expo. I think I mentioned that last week. So if you want to come out and see us both, come on out to the Blog World Expo. It's sometime in October, I forget, 15th, 16th, something like that, out in Vegas. Anyway, this is the last of our impromptu Honda Bob interviews from his 30-year picnic. And it's kind of weird. Maybe I should have put this one a little bit earlier, but I'm afraid the gentleman that I was interviewing became very shy when faced with a microphone. But I think you'll get the gist of how well Honda Bob takes care of his cars. All right, this time we have a really reluctant interview. What's your name now? He's not even going to admit his name. Come on, you were saying nice things about Bob.
Yeah, what's not nice about him?
Does he fix your cars?
Yes.
Does he do a good job?
Yes.
He was being really interesting as soon as I turned off the radio, but we're going to keep going here. What did you say about, you said something right before I picked it up.
I did?
Just let it out.
I'm putting this on. I'm doing it because you won't tell him anything.
All right, all right. He's been my mechanic for probably 20 years.
20.
So.
You said how old was your daughter when you first started with him?
She's a year. If that.
Oh, it's like Lindsay.
Wow. So what kind of car do you have?
A 2006 Honda Civic.
I thought you were going to say a Buick, the way you've been going here with me.
A PT Cruiser.
Oh.
But he won't touch that, right?
No.
So many people say, I wish there was a Chevy Bob, that kind of thing, right?
Uh-huh.
Do you find your friends are jealous?
No.
Do you ever tell anyone about Honda Bob?
All the time.
You're a real pain, aren't you?
Yes.
Why, thank you for your time.
Okay.
All right, I promise you that guy was reluctant. You see what I mean. But he does believe in Honda Bob. And I got to tell you, if you're lucky enough to live in the LA or Orange County areas and you would like the outstanding and convenient in-home care for your Honda or Acura like the rest of us have, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HGA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time of the week again. It is time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchat. It's my favorite time of the week. How are you, Bart?
I'm good. It's my favorite time, too.
Yay! Well, I kind of like gin and tonic time on Fridays, and I like Taco Bell Thursday, but, you know, it's right up there anyway.
I wish my week was so regimented.
It is actually pleasing to wake up on Thursday morning and go, oh, goody, I get Taco Bell today. Small pleasures. Oh, well. Wait, I wanted to start us off out of agenda here. We're not going to start with security light. I want to start out with I've decided to forgive you, Bart, for the fact that you don't like broccoli.
Oh?
See, back on episode 20, for anybody who hasn't been playing along for a long time, Bart and I had a big debate about which is worse, broccoli or Brussels sprouts, and we had a big poll done and...
Just a small correction. It wasn't what? Back at episode 20. It was episode 120.
Oh, 120. Okay, there we go. And so I was definitely in favor of broccoli, and Bart seems to think Brussels sprouts are worth something other than scrubbing your bathroom tile with them. And
I would use it for that.
Yeah, barely.
Any tile?
That's about all they're worth to me. But anyway, I was watching the Discovery Channel the other night and saw a show on the fact that there is a gene that makes you hate broccoli. It's called the PTC gene, and it was discovered in 1931 that it affected this. That he had some powdered PTC in a bottle, and some of this powder accidentally blew into the air. And a colleague standing nearby complained that the dust tasted bitter, but he couldn't taste anything at all. So they discovered that there was actually a difference between people who could taste it as very, very bitter and people who couldn't taste it at all. And some people tasted it just a little bit. And it turns out that PTC substance is alive and well in broccoli.
See, I'm not sure that actually gets me off the hook because both my parents really like broccoli.
Ah, well, we'll have to dig into this further and do some genetic analysis. But what I really like is, let's see, there's a line in here. It says, plants produce a variety of toxic compounds in order to protect themselves from being eaten. and PTC is one of them.
Hey, it works for me.
So this is a vegetable that's trying to have you not eat it. It's got a defense mechanism.
Well, it didn't start off trying to be a vegetable. It had no intention of becoming dinner. It just wanted to reproduce.
And not get eaten up. Anyway, if you would like to learn more about this, we have a link in the show notes to learn.genetics.utah.edu. That's quite entertaining.
Cool.
So let's go into the regular part of the show. What do we got going on Security Light, Bart?
Not really anything new. Just a small little update on what we talked about last week, particularly Firefox 3.5 having a bug in the JavaScript just-in-time processor, or JIT. That was a new feature in 3.5 to make JavaScript faster, but there was a bug in it, which left it basically a security vulnerability. The bug has been fixed in 3.5.1, and it actually was already fixed when the time the show came out last week, but the Mozilla people didn't actually bother updating their security blog. So the last post in their security blog still read, "There's a big flaw," and didn't read, "We have fixed the flaw," which is a flaw.
So the good news is we did a quick little bit flip on that last week to turn it off. So you can go back to last week's show notes and follow the instructions and change it from false to true, I think it was.
Yeah, last week we went into about :config, and we flipped something.jit from true to false. Now you can flip it from false to true.
All right, if you care.
Well, yeah, and in fairness, you know, faster JavaScript is a good thing. It's probably the biggest reason for moving to Firefox 3.5, so go ahead and do that. Actually, there is one other small update. For people who haven't updated to Firefox 3.5, there is Firefox 3.0.12 came out to fix a different vulnerability.
3.0.12. Oh, okay.
And right. What I have noticed is that Firefox will not update itself automatically from 3.0.x to 3.5.x. You have to manually download and do that update. Which is really annoying. I actually wanted to go and get that update. I don't see why the automatic updates won't jump between major versions, or at least give you the option.
Well, I wonder whether it's because it's, you know, you might have a whole bunch of plugins and it's sort of, you know, a major, major, major upgrade.
Sure. But give me a button called upgrade as well as update.
Ah.
You know, there is an upgrade available and there is an update available. Distinct things, but I want to be able to get them both through the interface. I shouldn't have to go to getfirefox.com to get Firefox from within Firefox.
Especially because more sophisticated, unsophisticated users wouldn't even know it's there.
Exactly. They're just doing automatic updates. So as far as they're concerned, I've been automatically updated. I must be on the latest version, having no idea they're an entire major version behind.
And the less sophisticated users probably have fewer plugins or more likely to need the newer version.
Yeah, and I have actually found that none of my plugins are affected by the move to 3.5.
I had Cool Iris broke, and I was like, oh, no, I can't live without Cool Iris. And then I went to the Cool Iris site, and they had an update for it immediately. I mean, like the day 3.5 came out. Iris rocks.
The APIs for the plugins in Firefox are becoming much more stable. So the only thing that usually needs updating is that when you create a Firefox plugin, you specify in its setup file what versions of Firefox it will work in. And some people are very conservative and will say 3.x. And other people, are very unconservative and just say it'll work in 3. anything, and therefore it'll just work fine. It won't need an update between 3.0 and 3.5. Whereas others are more conservative and will say that it works in 3.0.x. And some just say it'll work from 1 to 7. You
know? Those are ones you
and
want.
The chances are that's true, because those APIs used to change a lot in the early days before it went 1.0. But those days are gone.
Cool. I love Firefox. All right, well, let's move on to our supposedly dumb... We're actually going to do a dumb question here, but it's not so dumb of a question you're going to tell us.
Well, I call it a not-so-dumb question because it really isn't. It's quite a good question, which opens up a surprisingly large amount of discussion.
Yeah.
I got this as an email this morning, and I was starting to write a reply, and I realized it was becoming a book rather than a reply, and I said, no, I'm not going to do that. We'll talk about it and chit-chat across the pond. So I started doing my bullet-pointed notes, and I went... It's actually a big section, so we can cut out the other content and just concentrate on this.
Sounds good.
So anyway, it's an email from Paul from Peru.
I love Paul from Peru. He's fun. He's been around for decades.
He wrote me a lovely personal email before the question, and I just like to thank him for that. But I'm not going to read that out on air because I hate people saying nice things about me. I don't read them. By the way, it feels wrong to read them. It's like, oh, I'm Irish. I do modesty. I hate compliments.
Well, I'll try never to be nice to you then.
Did you ever notice that an American person, when you say, how are you, they say, I'm good, and an Irish person says, I'm not too bad.
Oh, interesting. Because it would be arrogant to say you're good?
Yeah, absolutely. How's it going? Not too bad. You know, maybe an optimistic Irish person say, okay. Or the other classic one, could be worse. But they will never say, I'm good. It's not done.
I love it. My favorite answer is thrilled to be here if they ask me that at work.
Very American.
A little bit of sarcasm, actually.
Right. Yeah, it depends on whether the sarcasm meter is actually functioning that day.
All right. So what did Paul from Peru ask?
Okay, so at home we have a small Airport Express, and I have to make a parenthesis here. I love the Airport Express. It's connected to my stereo, and since it drives the printer, for no specific computer must be on for anyone to use it. And I like printing stuff wirelessly and have people wondering how it's done. I also love its portability. On trips, I take it with me, and I'm able to share friends' internet that don't have Wi-Fi just by sticking the Ethernet cable in the plug in the wall, which is true. Anyway, I know it supports up to 10 clients, which is perfect for us. I know the Airport Extreme supports up to 50. Now, at her office, my mother has a couple of D-Link ones, 2100 AP, and asked me how many clients they could support. I said definitely more than 25, but I wasn't sure, so I looked online on the D-Link website, but nothing is stated anywhere. So the question is, does a limit of wireless clients a base station support really exist? Okay, sorry, Paul, but grammar not so good there. But I get what you mean. If so, why would Apple advertise the 50 users on its site? For most wireless routers, is then the limit the 254 IPs per local LAN?
So he's basically saying, is there a real limit, or are they artificially making up those limits?
Yeah. And where would these limits come from, I guess? So I figured the way to go about this is to talk about what routers actually do, and that will help us understand where limitations could possibly kick in. Okay. So at the very simplest level, a router is just a computing device which has the ability to talk to two networks and to pass information from one to the other. Usually that is the internet on one side and your home network on the other side, which is usually referred to as WAN for wide area network and LAN for local area network. So two networks, and the router bridges the two, and it passes packets over and back as needed. So if it's traffic that's meant for your LAN, the router takes it, looks at it, and goes, nothing for me to do here, and lets it go on its way. If it's traffic for the internet, the router takes it, runs it through itself, and pops it out into the WAN. So at the simplest level, that's what a router does.
I'm with you so far.
They also, a lot of routers will also act as a DSL or a cable modem. So they have a little bit of work to do when the packets that they know they have to send out to the WAN. They have to transcode it from regular old Ethernet, which is what's running in your LAN, into whatever proprietary format is used to get it, you know, to the cable company or through the DSL router or whatever. So it may be something like PPPoE, which is a common protocol for that kind of thing. It's peer-to-peer over Ethernet, if you care. So it has a bit of work to do that translation, and it has to do that for every packet going to or from the internet. It's also very common in modern home routers, in fact pretty much standards, to have network address translation, or NAT, which allows you to effectively use one public IP address to allow many private IP addresses access the internet. But to do that, every single solitary packet that goes to the internet has to be ripped open by the router and rewritten. Network address translation has to translate the addresses. And then it has to keep a table of all the different connections it's natting. So that takes a bit of work and a bit of memory to do that. Then most home routers will act as a DHCP server, so that takes a bit of work. They'll also generally act as caching DNS servers. Some routers will even act as VPNs. And wireless routers also have to encrypt and unencrypt every packet that goes to and from the Wi-Fi.
So they're doing a lot of work.
Yeah, and then some home routers even do more fancy stuff like port forwarding, DMZ, static HTTP leases, and so on. So there's quite a bit going on in that little box. You know, it may just look like a little box, but it's actually a little computer. And it only has so much CPU and so much RAM, so there's only actually so much it can do. And particularly for a small portable router like the Express, it is going to have a hard limit in terms of its power. And that, more than anything else, is going to define how much or how little it can do.
So let me take a breath here for just a second. So it's strange to me to think of the router as a computer, but that is what it is. It's got a CPU and RAM and everything but a video card, I suppose?
Yeah, it doesn't need a video card. Its interface is done through usually a web interface. So it actually has a little web server in there, which gives you the web page to configure it. It's usually running some version of Linux, to be honest.
Okay, so are you saying that its ability to serve out more wireless clients is limited by how much other work it has to get done, and whether and how much RAM and CPU is available to do those functions?
To a very large extent, the physical power is a limiting factor. That's the biggest difference between if you go into a corporation and look at one of their routers, they're not going to cost you $50 like a home router was. They're going to cost you up to $50,000 or more. And the reason is because those machines can deal with literally thousands of clients, and they do so by having multiple CPUs working in parallel with each other using really fancy algorithms and stuff, because they are, you know, pushing through gigabits of data a second. So, you know, the amount of raw grunt your router has will determine its price and its size. So corporate routers are huge things, you know. Little MiFi, teeny tiny little thing, but it's a router as well. And right, you were so saying it's a limit too.
Yeah, that's got a limit of 5. But I would have thought there would be a graceful degradation, that when I hit 6, it starts to slow down a lot. And I get to 7, it slows down even more. And by 8, it's to a crawl. It feels like dial-up. I wouldn't expect there to be a brick wall at 5. Like you go, I mean, they have to be forcing that to be true, right?
They force that to be true, but they're probably doing so because otherwise battery life would be even poorer. And, you know, there's good reasons to put in a soft limit to prevent you walloping into hard limits.
Right, right. But it is it would degrade gracefully or ungracefully, depending on if they didn't put in a hard limit, right? Or a soft limit, I should say.
For all you know, it may be degrading quite ungracefully as it gets to 5.
Hmm.
I mean, I don't know how much testing you've done with 5 clients.
I haven't done a lot at the same time. I think I had 2 people working at the same time constantly, and it was fine, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was just because it's a cell router, it's actually taking the EVDO signal, which isn't that fast in the first place. So you divide it by 5, all of a sudden everybody's on dial-up anyway, even if it had all the power necessary.
That is also true. That's certainly another factor. So there's plenty of reasons to keep something teeny tiny like the MiFi limited to 5. And for the Airport Express, keeping it limited to 10 is also quite sensible. But there's also more going on.
Hmm.
So Wi-Fi adds a different complexion to things. So far, everything I've said applies to all routers, be they Ethernet-based, Wi-Fi-based, or both. But Wi-Fi adds in an extra problem, which is the fact that Wi-Fi is a so-called broadcast medium. Any traffic on a Wi-Fi network is sent to all clients.
Oh,
so although
really?
A G network can do 54 kilobits per second, that's 54 kilobits in total between everyone.
Isn't that megabits per second?
It would be, yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes, 54 kilobits would be pretty poor.
I thought it was slow. So you're saying that if I send a chat to you through Adium, that since I'm over wireless, Steve's machine is picking it up as well?
Yes, but the Wi-Fi card, one of its jobs is to filter, so it looks at the signal. I mean, it's a radio signal, just like if you had a walkie-talkie and talked into it. Everyone hears that who's on the same channel as you.
Okay.
So one of the jobs of your network card is to listen to all the glup of traffic going by and look for all traffic directed at your MAC address. And you take that in and you pass that into the computer, and all the rest you ignore.
See, I thought the router did that. I didn't realize that the...
The client has to do that. It's on the air. It's literally your router. Look at your router as a guy on a walkie-talkie shouting 10111011110. That's all it is.
And I'm going, hey, wait a minute, that one's for me. But yeah, I heard exactly. It, and so did Steve. Okay.
Everyone hears it, but everyone, it's part of your networking stack to discard whatever is not for you. But if you have a custom network driver, a custom driver for your Wi-Fi card, you can do what's called snooping, which is how people steal people's data over Wi-Fi. If you don't encrypt it, someone else can sit outside with a laptop set to snoop, which means don't only pass me my stuff, pass me everything. Everything you see going by, pass it to me. And then if you don't have encryption, then they will see your credit card numbers whiz by and everything else.
Okay. Got
you. So that in itself limits what you can do. I wouldn't want to be sharing an access point with even 50 people.
Hmm.
Because at that stage, there's no bandwidth left.
Right.
And you might say, yeah, but the chances of all 50 people using the network at the same time must be very low. Well, this is where I would say, fire up a terminal, and there's a command you can type to see all of your network traffic. I'm going to try to remember this off the top of my head. I should have put this in the show notes. So it will be sudo tcp dump minus I eth0 if you're on Ethernet, or eth1 if you're on Wi-Fi. Hit return and type in your password, and I can't remember mine. device not found. It's not ETH0, it's EN0, I think, on most modern Macs.
Ah, that I thought something sounded funny about that.
Yeah, ETH0 is our servers and work. And you will just see a whole load of traffic, even if you're apparently doing nothing. And there's reasons for that. At the very lowest level, we're all using Ethernet. Wi-Fi uses Ethernet, and Ethernet uses Ethernet, the protocol. And Ethernet requires something called the Address Resolution Protocol, or ARP, to work, to provide a mapping from IP addresses to MAC addresses. And that's constantly chatting away. ARP is a broadcast protocol, and it's constantly going, which MAC address belongs to this IP address? I'm looking for this IP address. What's its MAC address? Hello, I've just turned on. Here's my MAC address, in case you're wondering. It's just a constant chatter of ARP traffic.
So it's like having a seven-year-old in the backseat of the car, reading all the signs as you drive by or something.
Yeah, so as well as that, if you have Windows machines on the network, if they're in a work group, they're constantly arguing with each other over who's the master browser for the work group, and they're having what are called elections, where they boast about each other's seniority, and then they decide who's going to be the boss for a while, and then a little while later, they just do it all over again, so they're yakking away to each other. Windows also tries to resolve machine names by broadcast, so every time someone tries to connect to someone else's machine name, as a broadcast goes out saying, hello, who is, Allison's PC, and so forth. So there's that constant chatter. Macs are no different. They're constantly yakking in MDNS, i.e. bonjour. So whenever you see in your finder, oh, look, so-and-so's machine has just turned on, the reason you know that is because there's a constant chatter of MDNS traffic going around, printers announcing their presence.
I was going to say, printers use bonjour too, right?
Hmm?
Printers use the equivalent of bonjour as well, and they're saying, hey, I'm here. Do anybody want to print to me? I'm right here. Hello?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So every time something turns on or turns off, and just periodically they remind each other, and every time someone's machine tries to do something, it may put out a request saying, yeah, I'd like to know everyone on the network who has the ability to print. You know, so there's a constant chatter of bonjour traffic. Then add to that the fact that we're pretty much always using things like IM clients. Even if we're not actively chatting, they're sitting there and they have a constant chatter going over Mac to the servers. Ajax-based web pages that update themselves. Like if you keep your Facebook homepage up, you see who comes online and who goes offline. There's a constant network chatter there. Twitter clients, syncing tools like MobileMe, Dropbox. I mean, I could go on. So when you think you're doing nothing, I'm just going to stop. I started off that capture and I'm now going to stop it. And in the time we've been talking on a machine, so I'm not doing this on the machine I'm talking to you on Skype on, because that will generate loads of traffic. I did this on my other Mac. In that time, 417 packets went by.
Wow.
And that machine was doing, for all intents and purposes, nothing.
So I can't believe the network works at all.
Yeah. So if you actually have enough people just on the network will keel over due to excess use, even though no one's doing anything, apparently. So that in itself puts a limit on your clients. Now, that limit is quite high if you have gigabit Ethernet. It's quite a bit lower if you're running on 100 megabits and really very, very low if you're running on 10 megabits.
And if you're on Wi-Fi, if you're on G, like you said, 54 megabits per second, that'd be pretty slow.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't want 50 computers in there yakking away. Regardless of the fact, even if none of them were doing any work, it'd still be a very busy network.
So you're saying even if you had a router that had a massive CPU or multi-CPUs and it had a ton of RAM and it was capable of it, the network would get saturated by that many people being on at the same time?
Exactly. Which is why if you go into a corporation, they don't have one wireless router. They have loads of them scattered all over the building, often five or six on each floor.
Right.
And the reason being is because each one will be on a different channel, so each one will have its own little bit of background chatter and stuff going on. So they'll segment the network.
I see.
Because there is a limit to how many clients can talk to one wireless base station.
So would it be true to say that having 50 clients on one wireless router would be basically as dumb as having way too many, a flat network with no subnets? That all that traffic, you get all those interactions with each other, it's just too much traffic on one node.
If they were all on Wi-Fi, I wouldn't like it. It wouldn't be an issue if they were all on Ethernet, but if they were all on Wi-Fi, I wouldn't be at all keen on being on that network. It would be very congested.
So Ethernet, just because it's got higher capacity at 100 megabit or gigabit, is that why?
100 megabit or gigabit, yeah, exactly. It can handle many more machines doing nothing. I think it took 3,000 machines to choke up our 100 megabit network and work before it was subnetted.
Wow.
At that point, what happened was that the chatter went up to 10 megs, and anyone who was still connected on an old 10 meg network card suddenly fell off the network because all they could get was the chatter.
good and proper, like you say, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the people with 100 megabit cards were happy enough to keep going because it was only 10% of CRUD. But anyway, that was on an Ethernet-based network. So Wi-Fi, again, because you're sharing that channel physically, there's only so many ones and zeros can be shared at the same time on the same channel, it builds up a lot quicker on Wi-Fi.
I see. Okay.
Okay, so as well as that, then some routers place arbitrary limits in their firmware. So the router simply says, I'm only going to deal with maybe 500 connections through my NAT, or I'm only going to issue 10 IP addresses through NAT, through DHCP. They'll implement those limits in an arbitrary sort of way. And that's fair enough.
And why are they doing that?
It could be one of a number of reasons. A, to protect the quality of service. B, because they want to sell you a more expensive product without the arbitrary limits. Or C, a bit of both.
Okay. That makes sense.
That hopefully gives you some idea of what's going on. But really, if you're going to buy a little D-Link router, don't run 50 people off it, even if it says it can. Not a good idea.
So it's actually, the ones that are smarter are the ones that do limit you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, the MiFi having a limit of 5 is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Yeah, now some other things to bear in mind. Paul mentions 254. I need to correct the show notes where it says 245.
Okay.
254 is the number of IP addresses in a Class C subnet. And you might think that that's going to put a limit on a router. It actually doesn't. You can program an Airport Extreme to work on a Class A or a Class B network, which would have... A Class B would have 254 times 254 possible IP addresses, and a Class A would have 254 times 254 times 254.
Ah!
It's a lot.
Okay.
At that point, you'd want to have a pretty quiet network, but you can segment the network behind your router. So I have a router, which is made of an old Dell PC, an old GX1 to be precise, and it has just two network cards, one facing the WAN and one facing the LAN. Now, that one network card facing the LAN then goes into a switch, which connects it up to three more switches and my wireless base station.
Isn't that overkill for, what, three or four computers in one house?
Yeah, but I have eight network points in my room.
Why?
Well, okay, I have a laptop I definitely want to give a network point to. I have my desktop. Oftentimes someone else to be visiting might want their laptop. If I'm experimenting, if I'm setting up a new PC for someone, I want to plug that in. It happens quite often that someone will hand me a machine to set up or whatever. So I just bring it in and just drop it into the network. I could probably get away with four.
Okay.
But they sell cheap 8-port routers, so I have an 8-port router.
Okay.
Then the better half is an 8-port router, and then there's an 8-port router sitting downstairs, which the main, or sorry, 8-port switch. These are all switches. And that breaks up the network a lot. So the network chatter on a switch tends to be quite confined to within that switch.
Okay.
Apart from the broadcasts. So you could actually, the routing bit of your router could probably deal with an awful lot. The Wi-Fi bit certainly will not, but the more traffic you try to put through it, the harder that poor CPU has to work.
So we have a, $100 Linksys router, 4-port mm-hmm. router with nothing hardwired into it at all. It serves out Wi-Fi to the 10 computers in our house.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you just have something like that?
Because my router does a lot more cool stuff.
So mine makes the internet go in my house.
Yeah. But mine, well, let me see this. I run a special Linux distribution called IPCOP on mine, which lets me set up stuff like traffic shaping, which allows me to prioritize certain traffic.
Like our Skype calls?
Traffic.
Do you put our Skype calls at the top of that list?
Yep. We work off a specified Skype port, so I can give that priority. I can say everything on, I think it's port, I can't remember what port number we use, but everything on the port number we use for Skype has a higher priority than everything else. I have email running on a low priority, web on a high priority. So you surf the net nice and snappy, and email sort of happens slowly in the background. And SSH, I think I have at the very highest priority, so that if I'm typing on the command line on some machine somewhere halfway across the world, I don't want that to be sluggish. I don't want to type A and then have to wait 5 seconds and see the A come up on screen. I want that instant.
Okay.
And then if someone were to want to do file sharing, I can bump that down to a very low priority.
Someone.
Someone. It wouldn't be me. Someone.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Likewise, if someone other than me wanted to game, I can, if I'm feeling generous, I can say, okay, fine, your game can go with the highest priority so you don't get a horrible lag.
I see. I guess
again,
I guess
that means I need more computing power. So I have a full PC as right. my router. So it has plenty of grunt.
And I think I follow you up through the high-powered PC. It's why you have three switches.
Yeah, pretty much.
Is that just because you want to be able to, because you're hardwiring in those rooms?
Oh, I hate Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi is just not a goer. If you want to transfer a 5 gig file from one PC to another over Wi-Fi, it's horrible. Do it over Ethernet.
How often do you need to do that?
Quite a bit, actually, because I have all my external drives plugged into the iMac, but I may want to access them from the laptop.
Ah, I see.
Suck it through the network. You know, OS X is great for mounting stuff over AFS, so I just mount the hard drive over AFS and work away as if it was local. But if I was doing it over Wi-Fi, the illusion would be shattered pretty quick.
Okay. I give in. You have some reasons.
Yeah, so the point is 254 isn't actually a limit on the router. The big limit is Wi-Fi.
Okay.
So if you have a router that has Ethernet ports, you could run loads of machines off it. You wouldn't have much bandwidth left from your internet connection if you divide it by that many people.
Right.
But you could run a lot through a regular router if it was all coming in over Ethernet. It wouldn't stress it out nearly as much. If you had an ISP that didn't make you do NAT, you could run even more because then the machine wouldn't have any work to do. It would just be saying, oh, pack it in, pack it out, pack it in, pack it out. But if you have to do NAT, then it has to translate every packet. And then suddenly the poor little thing gets hotter and hotter and hotter and falls over in a heap. I mean, if you don't believe me that there's a lot of computing going on in your router, you should hold your hand over and see how warm it gets.
Ooh, I had one smoke once. That was the end of that. Yeah, that was too hot. Yeah, we were flying. We had data going back and forth, back and forth. It's very exciting.
Yes.
So the bottom line is that these hard limits are to some extent arbitrarily assigned, but they represent a reality that you would hit anyway, and so it's better to have you stop and have the quality of service.
Yeah, I would say so, and certainly I would not particularly to get back to the Wi-Fi question. 50 clients on a Wi-Fi router is too much. So yeah, Apple will let you go to 50 on the extreme. You're not going to have a nice experience with 50 people on your access point.
I'm trying to picture a situation where I would need 50 people on an access point. You know, I'm running a small business. Yeah, right. That's a really geeky party.
Well, is there any other sort in the Sheridan household?
I guess not. Let me back up one little bit. When you're talking about Class E subnets and Class B mm-hmm. and all that, what is the 254 sounds like a magic number. What is it? Why is it 254, not 255?
Well, 256 is what you would expect, which is a power of 2.
Right.
But the top address in a subnet is the broadcast address, and the bottom address is the network address, so you always lose .0 and .255.
Ah,
so that leaves you at 1 to 255. Sorry, you always lose 255. Yeah. You lose 255 and you use 0, so that leaves you with 254 addresses.
Ah, okay, good. I knew there had to be some reason it was that number.
It's low-level binary network stuff.
Well, this does sound like it was a lot more complicated than an email could address.
Yeah, I think really the real takeaway message is that your router is a very busy little computer that's doing a lot of work for you. And that if you wanted to behave like a corporate router, you're going to have to spend the money on a corporate router.
I guess so. I'm appreciating the poor little thing now. I should treat it nicer.
Exactly. And if you really want to appreciate it, make yourself a little Linux distribution and build your own router, and then you'll understand what's going on under the hood. But I'd keep the other one on standby to bail you out so you can get on the internet and find out what you did wrong.
Yeah, I think I'll get right on that task, Bart. Maybe I'll make my my OLPC, my one laptop per child, into one.
Ooh, I don't think it'd do well. That's actually the one thing. Whenever something is wrong with the router and I have to update it, I always have to do all of my research and then start updating it, because once I start working on it, I don't have internet anymore.
Every time, right? All right, well, this was pretty cool. I enjoyed this. I learned a lot. And thank you to Paul from Peru for a stimulating, not-so-dumb question.
Absolutely. There was a lot of meat to it.
There you go. All right, Bart. Well, looks like we've got a schedule set up for next week. We will be able to record. And
yes, I think was it Sunday evening we decided on?
Yeah, I think we're going to just shift to Sunday. So there will be no interruption to the NoCellaCast listeners. No, nothing to worry about here.
Yes, and at our usual time, I'll be at a wedding reception probably getting quite drunk, because it will be an Irish wedding.
Sounds like fun. All right, Bert, we'll talk to you next week.
Okie dokie. Until then, happy computing.
Well, tonight we had a lot of fun testing out Stickam service instead of using Ustream. Now, I tried to get everyone in the chat room to vote thumbs up or thumbs down on Stickam versus Ustream. The problem with Ustream, the reason we were moving away from it, was because a lot of people had trouble getting into Ustream. They changed the interface and it got all borked up. People couldn't get in. Last week, Bart couldn't get in. So we switched over to Stickam, and Stickam's got a completely different interface, which confused a lot of us for quite some time. It's got a couple of advantages, like the people watching the show were able to come in on the right sidebar in video. So right now I can see Donald Burr and ZML 2009, Michael King and Evan, and that's kind of cool. The problem is, as soon as they come in, I can hear them, and worse yet, I can hear me talking, so I have to mute them really quick. I think there's a way I should be able to set them to, default to mute, but I just can't remember where the button was. So that was kind of good, but there's really offensive ads. There's a nearly naked woman on the page, which most of us found offensive. I'm not sure all of us did, but kind of creepy and annoying. There's sort of two interfaces. When you first go in, there's a button that says new interface, and I'm not sure which case was which, but in some cases, the video of me was a lot smaller. I did also have trouble that I can't get it to recognize my EyeSight camera in my big monitor, which is the one I normally use because that's the direction I'm looking. So right now I'm actually using the BT1, the Bluetooth camera, and it's picking that one up. But otherwise, it wants to default back to the EyeSight in my laptop, which is 90 degrees to me and completely blocked by the microphone. So that's not good. Let's see. Gita said that the IRC chat client can't get in, so that's not good. I was able to embed it on podfeet.com/live, which is kind of nice. But it turns out after I said that, everybody said, yeah, you can do that with Ustream, Allison. So I don't know which way we're going to go. I think we'll give this another try for another week. Maybe we can ring out the way to do it and people can help each other as they go in. But the main thing is that we have everybody in chat. And I think that's probably more important than almost any of these other factors. So anyway, if next week you can give us a try at 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 on Sunday, so between 5 and 6 p.m., all you have to do is go to podfeet.com/live, and you'll be able to see where we are. If I do end up switching back to Ustream, I'll just fix it there now that I know I can do that. So I better wind things up for tonight. Please keep all these great emails coming to allison@podfeet.com, and don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening. Stay subscribed.